Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Chairman. I'm afraid I'm not going to attempt to answer any of the interesting questions that you posed in your introduction. Instead, I'm going to talk about higher education policy. And that's partly because, until Monday, that's what I thought the subject of this debate was going to be about. But I have a better excuse than that, I hope, which is that economic growth, now the theme of our debate, has to be built on a platform of confidence and stability. And I'm going to suggest that these are two qualities that are in short supply in our higher education system at present. You can demonstrate this in a number of ways. For example, if 27 English universities have decided at this late stage of the game that a change in the rules means that they need to jig around with their fee structure for the next academic year, I think you can say that the system is unstable. My plan is to talk about the big picture, the three or four ways in which universities can and do contribute to economic dynamism and growth, and how these might be affected by policy changes. And I should start by emphasising that these views are my own rather than anybody else's. I'd like to also acknowledge that although I think there are quite a few things to worry about in the changes that are now underway, we could have been in a much more dangerous place. The fiscal crisis meant that the status quo was not an option. Big changes were inevitable one way or another. That's why whenever I see David Willetts or his colleagues now, I think of Hilaire Belloc. You remember how he put it, and always keep a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. University's biggest single contribution to a dynamic economy is well-educated graduates of all ages, churned out every year into the nation's workforce. This is by far the most important single form of knowledge transfer there is. And I think the radical changes that are now underway in the funding of teaching will affect different institutions in different ways. Those with the best brands, not necessarily the same as those who do the best job, should come out quite well. If they choose to do so, they'll be able to take on more students with the best A-level results. They'll be able to sustain a level of fees that could more than offset the loss of teaching subsidies taken across a range of disciplines. I think the outlook for many other institutions is much more uncertain. No way of knowing whether demand will continue to exceed supply of places across the system once fees rise so sharply. The betting seems to be that students from middle-income families will be relatively price-insensitive. But no one, I think, has the first idea about the likely behaviours of students from poorer backgrounds. And that's why lots of vice-chancellors, if you talk to them, will tell you they haven't a clue about how many people are going to be walking through their front doors next autumn. And that, in turn, I guess, puts a question mark over the potential new skills that will be flowing out into the economy in a few years' time. What kind of graduates, what disciplines, how many? There are a number of other uncertainties stuck in the sort of undergrowth of the policy changes. Perhaps of most interest to employers is what they might mean for the teaching of science, technology, engineering, and maths, the so-called STEM subjects so beloved of members of CBI and others. I think there are at least four sets of questions here. Since many more students do well at A-levels in humanities than they do in STEM subjects, will STEM students find it harder to find places in the best universities under the new quota system? Will the teaching subsidy that is still going to be paid out to support expensive to teach STEM subjects be big enough? Some universities say it won't. They'll lose out, they say, under the new arrangements, even if they charge the £9,000 fee. What will happen to the funding of postgraduate work? Well, we don't know. The white paper didn't touch on that. But it will. The answer will be especially important to STEM, where the falling proportion of home students in postgraduate courses is already, I think, a big worry. And the final question, HEFCE is proposing to offer protection for expensive to teach STEM places in the price-based margin of 20,000 students. Well, how will that work? How will it actually support students who are paying the lower fees in these expensive courses? High-quality teaching makes a critical contribution to a growing economy. And I think it'll be some years before we'll see how this will be affected by the changes that are now working their way through the system. A second vitally important contribution that universities make to economic performance lies in their role at the centre of a successful city or region. They're a magnet for talent and for forward investment, a hub for new ideas, creative thinking, innovation, a source of relatively well-paid jobs, often in regions where there are few others like that around. In an age of open universities, open innovation, universities are the partner of choice for business R&D. And we can all think of half a dozen cities in the UK, not just the obvious ones, where the local economy has been transformed by the relations that have been built between the academy and business. In fact, I think it's quite hard to think of a really successful city anywhere in the world that doesn't have one or two good universities at its heart. Well, a fair number of universities, as I've said, will be broadly unaffected by the changes. But there also will be some losers. And indeed, there is already speculation about the number that will struggle and may fail to survive in a much harsher environment. Just as a successful university is a tonic to the region in which it's located, so a failing institution would be a serious drag on the neighbourhood. And the problem, what to do about universities which may be unsustainable after the changes, I think is going to need a lot of thought. The second series of policy changes will also affect universities as their role for a magnet for talent in a city or a region. There are worrying reports about the sharp drop in applications, student applications from outside the EU, particularly from India, as a result of the stricter approach to visas. And then there was a powerful letter, I thought, in the FT on Monday from a group of economists warning that Home Office ideas, plans to reduce dramatically the number of non-European Union economic migrants who have the chance to settle in the UK would have a seriously adverse impact on growth. In their words, and I quote, "The policy could almost have been designed to deter the migrants who we most need, and for those who do come, to expel many of those we would most like to remain." And I think the university sector would be especially vulnerable to changes of that kind. Let's hope it's not too late to persuade the Home Office to change its mind. And I'm confident that the Minister and his colleagues in DBIS will be leading the charge on this one. Research, of course, is a third important way in which universities contribute to economic well-being and growth. And here, as has been said, the coalition government certainly does deserve three cheers for its decision to maintain the research budget, at least in nominal terms, when everything else was being cut back so heavily. It is, I think, though, important to remember that research takes years to translate into economic activity. Some never will. Investment here is not a short-term growth fix. Also, it's not a linear activity where you sort of pour in cash at one end and wait for commercial products or services to pop out at the other. It's very difficult to track the link, in fact, between investment in research and economic growth. Successful research collaboration is built around all kinds of different networks and disciplines and is not independent of the well-being of the universities in which it's located. In other words, it's tough to run a glitteringly successful research establishment in a weak or failing institutions. If universities are to make their full contribution to innovation and economic growth, they need to be confident about where they stand today and where they're heading tomorrow. It's inevitable at this stage of a radical programme of reform that there's a great deal of uncertainty around. I also think it's fair to say that, taken as a group, vice-chancellors have a tendency to cry wolf. Universities have had big shocks before, in the past, in the early 1980s, for example, and survived to tell the tale. But I think there is a reason to be anxious about the pace at which these changes are being driven through. The white paper came 6 months later than originally promised. A number of important consultations are still open or just closing. New structure is complex. The pace and direction of competition from new entrants from the private sector is hard to judge. Impossible to work out, I think, how the model of a multidisciplined institution with some courses cross-subsidising the others will be sustainable once private sector cherry-picking really gets going. I think there could be some quite big changes there. I think it's also hard to find anyone who really thinks that these new arrangements will be sustainable over anything more than the next few years. One thing it's not at all clear how much they will end up costing the taxpayer. There are certainly those who believe that the government is being too optimistic in its assumptions about what proportion of the student loans will actually be repaid in the end. And there are those who think that the proportion of non-payers will be so high that actually the new policy will cost more than the ones it replaces. And then what happens? Depending on the pace of inflation, too, it may not be all that long before we have to start thinking about the level of the fee cap again and go through the whole ghastly process once more. A test of any policy outcome, I think, is to ask what the policymakers would have said if you'd suggested to them ahead of the event that this was what was going to happen. My guess is that if you'd described the current plans to the coalition parties, both Conservative and Lib Dems, after the last election, they would have said you were nuts. So how did we get to this point? Well, the answer, I think, is pretty clear. In the run-up to the big spending decisions last autumn, the Department of Business faced a very big problem. It was the largest spending department not to be protected in any way by any kind of ring fence. Universities were the biggest single item on its budget. Really dreadful political choices ahead. Sharp cuts in student numbers, salami slicing of funding, tuition fee increases, maybe a combination of all three. Then along came the 7th Cavalry in the shape of Lord Brown and his review, a sort of magic bus pass, putting most of the funding for teaching in the hands of students rather than the universities would bring very dramatically large, immediate cash savings. Of course, it would also bring contingent liabilities in the shape of the burgeoning student loan book, but that wouldn't show up for quite a period and wouldn't show up in the spending numbers anyway. So it was a good bit of smoke and mirrors, but I think compared with any likely alternative, better, certainly in political terms, probably in economic terms. The changes were ideologically attractive too, since it placed power in the hands of the student and could be presented as a shift towards competition and market forces. Pretty odd sort of market, really, where prices are capped, numbers are capped, severe information asymmetries, heavy-handed government intervention needed to make it work. But still, the changes more or less fitted in with a broader narrative. But of course there was a problem, and that was the Lib Dems, who had campaigned on the basis of abolishing tuition fees, never dreaming for a moment that they would end up with their hands on the levers of power. They were going to be in big trouble on tuition fees, whatever happened, but they surely couldn't stomach Lord Brown's idea of removing the fee cap altogether. And it was important for them that the system should be seen as progressive, with an emphasis on widening access. So the Brown review needed to be recooked. The government says that it has accepted roughly 85% of Brown's recommendations, but it's the 15% that were left out which has left at least some members of Lord Brown's team hissing with frustration. So far as I know, the decision to set a standard fee of 6,000, going up to 9,000 in exceptional circumstances, was not based on detailed research. Indeed, frankly, Nick Clegg gave the impression he thought that the university regulator had the power to set fees for each university. In the event, the decision ignored the fact that universities are brilliant at gaming such proposals, and that for most it would actually be in their interests to go as close to the 9,000 mark as they possibly could. Demand for places running ahead of supply. Universities that charge lower prices might be saying something about itself that it'd rather not do. Inflation rising, probably the last time for a year or four that they would have a chance to get ahead of the game. The coalition ignored another of Brown's ideas, which was that the university should pay a levy on the income from fees above £6,000 to cover the extra cost to the taxpayer, the upfront student loan fees. So it quickly became clear that there wasn't going to be competition, very little competition on prices, and that the high level of fees was going to push up the costs of funding student loans. So it's no wonder, I think, that the white paper took so long to emerge. As it became ever clearer how universities were going to play this game, this must have been one of the most painfully sensitive points in the whole of the coalition relationship. Somehow or another, a way had to be found to shift the needle in a different direction. And that's how we come up with a scheme which, on my bad days, I think is worthy of Gosplan. A system where places at the top end are reserved for candidates with A-level scores of AAB or better, of which a university can take as many as it wants and can manage, and where another 20,000 places will go into a separate pool to be competed for by institutions who average fees don't exceed 7,500. I think I've got that right. No wonder so many institutions are now scrambling to revise their plans. So what are the likely consequences of all this? Well, I think top-ranked universities will probably benefit from a flight to quality as the best qualified students, not necessarily the best students, but the best qualified students, home in on the best-ranked institutions, which will be allowed to accept more of them, as I say, than they are today. There'll be a growing number of for-profit entrants at the other end of the scale, offering courses which don't cost much to put on, like business, and which don't have to cross-subsidise expensive courses such as engineering. Some of the post-92 universities, which offer low-cost courses and have a great record of getting their students into jobs, will do okay. Others, I think, will find themselves locked in combat with the local FE colleges for candidates. Some of the middle-rank universities, including a few members of the Russell Group, I think will have a sticky time. Their high fees will be hard to justify in a more competitive world. Newcomers will be cherry-picking their most profitable courses. There is already, increasing competition from continental Europe, where universities like Madrid and Maastricht are offering competitive English language courses for free. And their revenues will be much more volatile. I think that's not been emphasised enough. Their revenues will be a lot more volatile than they are today as student preferences shift around. So they're difficult times ahead. So what should the government do now? Well, three things above all, I would suggest. I think it should work really hard to give prospective students and their families the information they need to make sensible choices about the costs and benefits of going to university and about what different institutions have to offer. I guess inevitably the rather piecemeal way in which the policies have been launched, with all the focus really, because that's what came first and was the most dramatic, on tuition fees, that means there is a lot of catching up to be done on the communications front. The government has now set up this independent task force on student finance information. I really don't know how that's going, but I hope it's going well. Second, I think there's a lot to be said for the wise advice of the Department of Business Select Committee's report, published a couple of weeks back, which is that the policy makers should take their foot off the accelerator for a bit and allow the changes that have already been announced, give it time to settle down to create greater stability. In the Select Committee's words, we strongly believe that the reform should be implemented as a package and not in a piecemeal way, as both students and universities need certainty in a new system if they are to make informed decisions. We therefore urge the government to ensure that its delivery programme has sufficient flexibility to accommodate a later implementation to deliver its reforms. In other words, as I say, more stability. Finally, and I think most important, I think the government should be bolder in its aspirations for our university system. And I'm sure that's what the minister is going to be this evening when he comes back from voting. Of course, universities are a powerful engine for innovation and economic growth, no doubt about it. And of course, they need to turn out high-achieving graduates for the workforce. But of course, too, they're about much more than that. Maybe the neighbours here tonight, the British Academy, just over the road there, was being harsh when it said the implications of the new policies, quotes, are that study at university is only successful if it leads to a higher salary in employment. Maybe that's a bit unkind. But I think we must never lose sight of the fact that higher education is a public as well as a private good, bringing benefits to the nation as a whole. Thank you very much.